Death wants, apparently. Wouldn't that be nice? Ulyar murmured, a faint wisp of hope tugging at him. Rumors around here were as cheap as hardware problems, and he certainly wasn't ready to take any of this at face value. But if the Jedi had genuinely signed on to the project, maybe things would finally start to turn around. So when is this all supposed to happen? Any day now, Tarkosa assured him. He grinned lopsidedly. Hey, have a little faith. Come on, let's go get Keely and hit the Tabcalf for dinner. You go ahead, Ulyar told him, turning back to the pantry and pulling out a packaged ship's ration. I'll save my celebrating until the Jedi are actually here. What is your profession? Thrawn asked in Chiyun. I am a merchant trader. Cardass said carefully in the same language, forcing the odd sounds through unwilling tongue and lips. Thrawn lifted his eyebrows politely. You are a fishing boat? He asked, switching to basic. Cardass looked at Maris. That's what you said, she confirmed, an amused smile on her face. He lifted his hand slightly, let it fall back into his lap. I am a merchant trader, he said, giving up and switching over to the Minisiat trade language. Ah, Thrawn said in the same language. You're a merchant trader. Yes, Cardass shook his head. I really said I was a fishing boat? Boskaptorian. Boskaptorian, Thrawn pronounced. Can you hear the difference? Cardass nodded. And I practiced that all evening, too, he grumbled. I warned you Chiyun would most likely be beyond your physical capabilities, Thrawn reminded him. Still, your increase in comprehension level has been quite amazing, especially after only 5 weeks. And your progress with Minisiat over the same period has been nothing less than remarkable. I'm impressed. His glowing eye shifted to Maris. With both of you, he added. Thank you, Commander, Cardass said. To have impressed you is high praise indeed. Now you flatter me, Thrawn warned with a smile. Is that the correct word? Flatter? The word is correct, Cardass confirmed. Whatever progress he and Maris might have made with their studies, Thrawn's own work on BASIC had far surpassed them. A feat rendered all the more remarkable, given how much less time he had to devote to language studies. But I would argue with the usage, he added. Flattery implies exaggeration, or even falsehood. My statement was the truth. Thrawn inclined his head. Then I accept the tribute as given. Today's lesson is over. I must see to my guest. Guest? Maris asked, as she and Cardass also stood up. An admiral of the Chiss defense fleet is on her way to take possession of the Vagari vessel, Thrawn said as they all headed to the door. Nothing you need to concern yourselves with. May we observe the welcoming ceremony with you? Cardass asked. This time we should be able to understand what's being said. I believe that will be permissible, Thrawn said. Admiral Alani will certainly have heard of your presence from Aristokra Chaff Form Bintrano, and will want to see you for herself. Are they both from the same family? Maris asked. Thrawn shook his head. Senior officers of the defense fleet belong to no family. They're stripped of family name and privilege and made part of the defense hierarchy in order that they may serve all Chiss without deference or prejudice. So military command is merit-based and not something that comes from family connections? Maris asked. Exactly, Thrawn confirmed. Officers are taken into the hierarchy once they've proven themselves, just as the ruling families themselves select merit adoptives. What are merit adoptives? Cardass asked. Chiss brought in from outside a family's bloodlines to enrich or diversify or invigorate, Thrawn told him. All warriors are made merit adoptives when they're accepted into either the defense fleet or the expansionary fleet. He tapped the burgundy patch on his shoulder. That's why every warrior wears the color of one of the families.
Which one is yours? Maris asked.
The eighth, Thrawn said.
They reached the welcoming chamber to find that it had already been configured for the new arrival. The wall and ceiling hangings were totally different from those for Aristokra Chaform Bintrano's arrival, and to Cardass's eye, the arrangement seemed less elaborate. Perhaps even a senior military officer didn't rank as highly as a distant relative of one of the ruling families.
The ceremony will be considerably shorter and less formal than the last one you witnessed, Thrawn said, as he gestured them into positions flanking him but two paces back. You should be able to follow.
He seemed to consider, then favored them with a small smile.
The Admiral's appearance may surprise you a bit as well. I'll look forward to hearing your thoughts later.
He turned toward the door and nodded to one of the warriors. With a melodious chiming that reminded Cardass of a water carillon, the door slid open and four black-clad Chiss warriors came through, taking up flanking positions on either side. Wondering what Thrawn had meant by their guest's appearance, Cardass straightened into his best approximation of military attention as a tall female Chiss stepped into view. Only, instead of the normal black uniform, she was dressed from collar to boots in dazzling white. The Admiral stepped to the center of the room and stopped.
In the name of all who serve the Chiss, I greet you, Admiral Ar-Alani,
Thrawn intoned, taking a step toward her.
I accept your greeting and greet you in return, Commander Meet Rona Yurudo,
the Admiral responded.
Do you guarantee my safety and the safety of my crew?
I guarantee your safety with my life and the lives of those of my command, Thrawn said, bowing his head low. Enter in peace and with trust.
Ar-Alani bowed in return.
Who are these who stand behind you?
She asked, her tone subtly changed. And with that, apparently, the ceremony was over.
Visitors from a distant world, Thrawn told her, half turning to gesture them forward. Cardass and Ferassi, may I present Admiral Ar-Alani?
We are honored, Admiral, Cardass said in Chiyun, trying to duplicate the bow he'd just seen Thrawn make.
Ar-Alani seemed to draw back.
Aristokra Chaform Bintrano didn't tell me they spoke Chiyun, she said, an unpleasant edge to her tone.
Aristokra Chaform Bintrano didn't know,
Thrawn countered politely.
He spent little time here, and showed no interest in learning about my guests.
Ar-Alani's eyes flicked to him, came back to Cardass.
The report said there were three of them.
The third is otherwise occupied, Thrawn said. I can summon him if you wish.
Ar-Alani lifted her eyebrows.
He is allowed to roam freely through an installation of the Chiss expansionary fleet?
Thrawn shook his head.
All three are under constant surveillance. You are studying them, then?
Of course, Thrawn said, as if that was obvious.
Cardass suppressed a grimace.
And what have you learned?
Ar-Alani asked.
A great deal, Thrawn assured her. But this is neither the time nor the place to discuss it.
Ar-Alani's eyes flicked to Thrawn's warriors, still standing at attention against the welcoming chamber walls.
Agreed, she said.
I presume you'll wish to tour the captured vessel before you take it in tow,
Thrawn went on.
I have a shuttle waiting.
Good, Ar-Alani said, reaching to her belt and touching the smoothly curved shape of a Chiss comlink fastened there.
Let me summon my passenger, and we'll go.
Thrawn's eyes narrowed, and for the first time, Cardass sensed a flicker of surprise in his face.
No passengers were mentioned.
His presence is not officially sanctioned by the defense fleet,
Ar-Alani said.
I brought him here as a favor to the eighth ruling family.
Behind her, a young Chiss male stepped into view. His short robe and tall boots composed of a patchwork pattern of gray and burgundy, a slight smile on his face.
Thrawn stiffened.
Thras!
He breathed. He stepped toward the other as he entered the chamber, meeting him halfway. Reaching out his right hand, he grasped the other's right arm at the elbow as the other gripped his in return.
"Welcome," he said, smiling. "This is a surprise indeed."
"An achievement I have rarely achieved," the other said, inclining his head. He was still smiling, but Cardass could see hints of tension lines around his eyes as his gaze shifted over Thrawn's shoulder. Thrawn obviously noticed the shift. "My guests," he said, releasing the other's arm and gesturing at the humans. "Cardass and Farassi, Corellan traders from the Galactic Republic. Cardass and Farassi, this is Syndek Mithras Safis of the 8th ruling family." He smiled a little wider.
"My brother."
"Your brother?" Maris breathed.
"And they speak Cho'un,"
Mithras Safis said, his tone darkening a little.
"After a fashion," Thrawn said.
"Admiral Ar-Alani and I were on our way to visit the captured pirate vessel. Would you care to accompany us?"
"That's the main reason I'm here," Mithrasophis said.
"The main reason?" Thrawn asked. The other's lip twitched.
"There are others."
The alien bodies had long since been removed from the ship, but there were many other details and deductions that Thrawn was able to point out as the group passed down the corridors. Everything from the probable physical characteristics of no fewer than 3 different species of Agari slaves, all the way to the equipment their masters had probably permitted them to use. Cardass hadn't heard any of this analysis, and listened in fascination to the commander's monologue. Again, Ar-Alani and Mithrasophis absorbed the information in silence. Until, that is, they reached the treasure room.
"Ah, there you are."
Kento's deep voice boomed from one of the back corners, waving with one hand as he clutched what looked like an ancient decorated battle shield with the other.
"What's this alien doing here?"
Ar-Alani demanded.
"He's helping catalog the items for me,"
Thrawn replied.
"What did he say?"
Kento called, looking at Maris. She looked questioningly at Thrawn.
"In Sybisti, if you please,"
the commander said, switching to that language.
"Yes, commander."
She turned back to Kento and translated Thrawn's last comment.
"Oh, I'm helping catalog, all right,"
Kento said, eyeing the newcomer suspiciously.
"I'm also picking out the items I'll be taking home with me."
"What items are these?"
Ar-Alani asked in Chiyun, her glowing eyes narrowing.
"Commander?"
"In Sybisti, if you please, Admiral," Thrawn reminded her.
"This is not an interspecies conversation circle,"
Ar-Alani countered tartly, ignoring the request.
"What exactly have you promised these aliens?"
"They're merchants and traders," Thrawn reminded her, his own voice going a little stiff. "I've offered them some of the items as compensation for their weeks of service."
"What service?"
Ar-Alani demanded.
"You've provided them with food and living quarters, taught them Chiyun, and for this they deserve compensation?"
"There's plenty here for both our visitors and the Ascendancy," Thrawn said.
"If you'll come this way, there are some details of the engine room I'd like to show you."
He took a step toward the door.
"A moment,"
Ar-Alani said, her eyes back on Kento and the shield he was still defiantly gripping.
"Who will decide which items your humans will be permitted to take?"
"My intent was to leave that decision largely to Captain Kento," Thrawn said.
"He's been working on this inventory for some weeks now, and has an extensive knowledge of the contents. I can provide you with a copy of the complete listing before you leave."
"A listing of what's in here now?"
Ar-Alani asked. "Or a listing of what was here before he removed his chosen items?"
"Both lists will be available," Thrawn assured her, taking another step toward the door. "And my spot checks have shown the lists and descriptions are accurate enough.
At any rate, you'll have time on the voyage home to examine both the lists and the treasures themselves."
"Or I could examine them right now,"
Aralani said, gesturing to one of her two warriors.
You, get the listing. I think, Commander, that I'd prefer to take my own inventory.
As you wish, Admiral, Thrawn said. Unfortunately, I'll be unable to assist you in that task. There are administrative matters that require my attention.
I can make do without your assistance,
Aralani said. Make sure I have a shuttle with which to return to my ship when I'm finished. Her eyes flicked to Thrawn's brother.
And I think it would be wise if Syndic Mithr Ras Safis remained with me. With the Syndic's permission, of course.
I have no objections, Mithras Safis assured her. To Cardass's eye, his face looked a bit troubled.
Then I'll look forward to conversing again with you at your convenience, Thrawn said.
Catching Cardass's eye, he nodded toward the door. They were 20 meters down the corridor before Cardass dared to speak.
You don't really have any administrative work to deal with, do you?
He asked Thrawn, keeping his voice low.
You just wanted to get away from the Admiral for a while.
A harsh accusation, Thrawn said mildly. You'll tarnish Ferassi's high opinion of me.
Ferassi's?
Cardass looked behind him to discover that Maris had indeed followed them out of the treasure room.
Oh, hi, he said lamely.
I think you missed the point, George, she said. Commander Thrawn didn't duck out on the Admiral. He maneuvered her into deciding on her own to stay behind.
They rounded a corner, and Thrawn abruptly picked up his pace.
I've had a report of another Vagari attack. This one's still in progress, he said. I'm going to take a look.
How far away is it?
Cardass asked. It's approximately 6 standard hours away, Thrawn said.
Cardass's stomach tightened.
You're not just going there to observe, are you? The purpose of the trip is to evaluate the situation, Thrawn said evenly. But if I judge there's a reasonable chance of eliminating this threat to the Chiss Ascendancy...
He left the sentence unfinished, but there was no doubt as to his intentions.
He was going to attack.
"1 minute to breakout," the helmsman called.
"Acknowledged," Thrawn replied.
"Warriors, stand ready.
If the reports are accurate, we'll arrive in a safe area a short way beyond the outer edge of the battle zone," Thrawn said, his eyes dropping to the helmets gripped in Cardass and Maris's hands.
"Still, it would be wise for you to have your helmets already in place."
"We can get them on fast enough if we need to," Maris assured him.
Thrawn hesitated, then nodded.
"Very well. Then stand ready."
He swiveled back to face forward. Cardass watched the countdown timer, his mouth feeling uncomfortably dry. And as it hit zero, the star lines appeared out of the hyperspace sky and collapsed into stars. And through the canopy, he found himself staring at the most horrific sight he'd ever witnessed. It wasn't the simple pirate attack he'd expected, with 3 or 4 Vagari marauders preying on a freighter or starliner. Stretched out before them, writhing against the backdrop of a cloud-flecked blue-green world, were at least 200 ships of various sizes locked in battle, linked together in twos or threes or groups by savage exchanges of laser and missile fire. In the distance, on the far side of the planet, he could see the glittering points of 100 more ships, silently waiting their turn. And through the swirling combat drifted the debris and bodies and dead hulks of perhaps 20 more ships. This wasn't a pirate attack. This was a war.
"Interesting," Thrawn murmured. "I seem to have miscalculated."
"No kidding," Cardass said.
"No, you misunderstand," Thrawn said.
"I knew the battle would be of this scale.
What I hadn't realized was the Vagari's true nature."
He pointed through the canopy at the distant cluster of ships.
"You see those other vessels?
The ones waiting their turn to fight?"
"They're not here to fight,"
Thrawn corrected him.
"Those are the civilians. The error I spoke of was that the Vagari aren't simply a strong, well-organized pirate force.
They're a completely nomadic species.
Is that a problem? Maris asked.
Very much so, Thrawn told her, his voice grim. Because it implies, in turn, that all their construction, support, and maintenance facilities are completely mobile.
So?
Cardass asked.
So it will do us no good to capture one of the attackers and use its navigational system to locate their homeworld, Thrawn said patiently. There is no homeworld.
He gestured out of the battle.
Unless we can destroy all of their war vessels at once, they will simply melt away into the vastness of interstellar space and regroup.
Cardass looked at Maris, feeling a fresh wave of tension ripple through him.
Commander, calm yourself, Cardass, Thrawn said soothingly. I don't propose to destroy them here and now.
Interesting. He pointed out into the melee. Those two damaged defenders, the ones trying to escape, you see them?
No,
Cardass said, looking around. Over there, Maris said. Those two ships heading to starboard with a triangle of fighters behind them.
Okay, right,
Cardass said as he finally spotted them.
What about them?
Why haven't they jumped to hyperspace?
Thrawn asked.
Their engines and hyperdrives appear intact.
Maybe they feel it would be dishonorable to abandon their world, Maris suggested.
Then why run at all?
Cardass said, frowning at the scenario.
Cardass is correct, Thrawn said. I wonder.
There!
Abruptly, with a flicker of pseudo-motion, the lead ship had made the jump to safety. A moment later, the second also flickered and vanished.
I don't get it, Cardass said. What were they waiting for? Clearance?
In a sense, yes, Thrawn said. Clearance from the laws of physics.
But they were already clear of the planet's gravity field.
From the planet's field, yes, Thrawn said. But not from the Vagari's.
He looked up at them again, a glitter in his glowing eyes.
It appears the Vagari have learned how to generate a pseudo-grav field.
Cardass felt his jaw drop. And this means what to us? Thrawn gestured at the canopy.
The Vagari are obviously using it to keep their prey from escaping until they can be obliterated. I think perhaps I could find more interesting uses for such a device.
Cardass felt his stomach tighten.
No. Oh, no. You wouldn't.
Why not?
Thrawn countered, his eyes sweeping methodically across the battle scene.
Their main attention is clearly elsewhere. And whatever defenses they have around their gravity projectors will be arrayed against a possible sortie from their victims.
You assume?
I saw how they defended their treasure ship, Thrawn reminded him. I believe I have a good sense for their tactics.
Which translated meant that Cardass had zero chance of talking him out of this lunatic scheme.
Maris?
Don't look at me, she said. Because he's right. If we want to grab a projector, this is the time to do it.
There,
Thrawn said abruptly, pointing.
That large spherical gridwork.
I see it, Cardass said with a sigh of resignation. The sphere was near the Chiss edge of the battle, where they could get to it without having to charge halfway through the fighting. There were three large warships hovering protectively between it and the main combat area. But only a handful of Vagari fighters actually within combat range of it. Thrawn swiveled around toward the port side of the bridge.
Tactical analysis. We've located five more of the projectors, Commander. The Chiss at the sensor station reported. All are at the edges of the battle area. All more or less equally well defended. Analysis of the projector layout and the jump pattern of the escaped vessels indicates the gravity shadow is roughly cone-shaped, another added.
Are the three defending war vessels within the cone? Thrawn asked.
Yes, sir.
The Chiss touched a key, and an overlay appeared on the canopy, showing a wide, pale blue cone stretching outward from the gridwork sphere into the battle zone.
Does the projector itself appear collapsible? Thrawn asked. Unable to obtain design details at this distance without using active sensors, the Chiss at the sensor station reported.
Then we'll need a closer look, Thrawn concluded.
Signal the fighters to prepare for combat. Hyperspace course setting of 004x057. Once in place, they're to clear out the enemy fighters and create a defensive perimeter between the projector and the war vessels. The Springhawk will follow and attempt to retrieve the sphere. Assault teams 1 and 2 are to prepare for outhull operation, Thrawn said. There will most likely be an operational crew aboard the projector. They're to locate and neutralize with minimal damage to the projector itself. They'll be joined by Chief Engineer Yala Avikima and three of his crew, who will either find a way to collapse the projector to a size we can take aboard, or else attach it as is to our hull for transport. All groups are to signal when ready. 3 minutes later, the fighters and assault teams had all signaled their readiness.
Stand by, fighters, Thrawn said, his eyes on the battle. Fighters, attack now.
In the distance, there was a flicker of pseudo-motion, and the six Chiss fighters appeared in a loose line just off the projector's starboard side.
Helm, prepare to follow.
The enemy ships got off perhaps 2 shots each before the Chiss settled into their own counterattack, and the Vagari fighters began exploding. Less than a minute after their sudden arrival, the Chiss held the field alone. Alone, but not unnoticed. In the near distance, the three larger warships were beginning to respond, their aft batteries opening fire as they began ponderously turning around.
Fighters, take defensive positions, Thrawn ordered. Helm, go.
Cardass set his teeth. The stars began their usual stretch into star lines. Then, with a horrible sounding thud from somewhere aft, the stars were back.
Assault 1 to projector's starboard side, Thrawn called. Assault 2 to port. Chief Yal Avikima, you have 5 minutes.
Question is, do we have 5 minutes?
Cardass muttered.
I think so, Thrawn said. They'll need to be much closer before they can attack in earnest. Otherwise, they risk overshooting us and destroying their own projector.
So? Cardass countered. Isn't that what they probably think we're trying to do to it?
Actually, I suspect they're rather confused about our intentions at the moment, Thrawn said. An attacker whose sole purpose was destruction would hardly have had to move in this close.
He gestured toward the battle. But whatever they perceive our plan to be, they still must allow the projector to remain functional as long as possible. Once the gravity shadow vanishes, the defenders inside its cone will be free to escape and possibly regroup. They thus cannot risk overshooting us, and must come in closer. The enemy warships had made it halfway around now, allowing them to bring their flank laser batteries into play. Still, so far, they did seem to be concentrating most of their fire on the Chiss fighters arrayed against them. And then, as the light of the distant sun played across the warship's sides, Cardass spotted something he hadn't noticed before.
Hey, look, he said, pointing. They have the same bubbles all over their hulls that we saw on the treasure ship.
Get me a close-up, Thrawn ordered, his eyes narrowing. On the main monitor display, the running series of tactical data vanished and was replaced by a hazy telescopic view of the bubble pattern. Cardass felt his throat suddenly tighten, as beside him, he heard Maris's sharp intake of breath.
Oh no, she whispered.
The bubbles weren't observation ports, as Kanto had once speculated, nor were they navigational sensors. They were prisons. Each one contained a living alien being. All of them of the same species as the mangled bodies Cardass could see floating among the battle debris.
Living shields, Thrawn murmured, his voice as cold and as deadly as Cardass had ever heard it.
Can your fighters use their Connor nets? Cardass asked urgently. You know those things you used on us.
They're still too far away, Thrawn said. At any rate, shock nets would be of little use against the electronic compartmentalization of war vessels that size.
Can't they shoot between the bubbles? Maris asked, her voice starting to shake. There's room there. Can't they blast the hull without hitting the prisoners?
Again, not at their distance, Thrawn said. I'm sorry.
Then you have to call them back, Maris insisted. If they keep firing, they'll be killing innocent people.
Those people are already dead, Thrawn replied, his voice suddenly harsh.
Maris flinched back from his unexpected anger. But...
Please, Thrawn said, holding up a hand. Understand the reality of the situation. The Vagari have killed them, all of them, if not in this battle, then in battles to come. There's nothing we can do to help them. All we can do is focus our resources toward the Vagari's ultimate destruction, so that others may live.
Assault 1 reports Vagari crew has been eliminated, one of the crewers called. Chief Yal Avi Kima reports that they've located the projector's collapse points and are folding it for transport. Assault 2 is assisting.
Order Assault 1 to assist as well, Thrawn said. I thought there would be some sort of quickset arrangement, he added to Cardass. The Vagari wouldn't want to hold position for hours as they assembled their gravity projectors in full view of their intended victims.
He looked back at the Vagari warships, their turns now nearly completed, and his mouth briefly tightened.
Stand ready to fire on the war vessels.
Cardass looked at Maris, but her back was to him, her shoulders hunched rigidly beneath her vex suit.
Weapons ready.
Weapons ready.
Fire full missile bursts on my command,
Thrawn said. His eyes flicked to Maris.
And instruct the fighters to fire shock nets at the war vessel's bridge and command sections at the moment of minimum visibility.
Acknowledged.
Fire missiles,
Thrawn ordered.
Chief Yal Avi Kima, you now have 2 minutes.
Chief Yal Avi Kima acknowledges and estimates the projector will be collapsed on schedule. Across by the distant warships, there were multiple flashes of light as the Chiss missile struck.
Helmets!
Someone barked. Cardass reacted instantly, snatching up his helmet and throwing it over his head, peripherally aware that everyone on the bridge was doing the same. He had locked the helmet onto its collar and was looking for the source of the threat when there was a sudden burst of light and fire, and the port side section of the canopy disintegrated. Through the deck, he felt the thud of airtight doors slamming shut, and for a fraction of a second, he heard the wail of warning alarms before the sudden decompression robbed them of any conducting medium. Blinking against the dark purple afterimage of the flash, he peered through the still swirling debris at the impact point. It was as bad as he'd feared. The three Chiss who'd been closest to the blast were lying twisted and crumpled on the deck. Other Chiss had also been thrown from their chairs, though most of them appeared to still be alive. He was still assessing the damage when Maris suddenly shoved past him, nearly knocking him off his feet, and dropped to her knees beside the command chair. It was only then that he saw that Thrawn, too, was lying on the deck, his glowing eyes closed, a violently fluttering tear in the chest of his vac suit leaking away his air.
Commander!
He snapped, dropping to the deck beside Maris and fumbling in a suit pocket for a sealant patch.
Medic!
I've got one, Maris said, a patch already in hand. Ripping off the protective backing, she slapped it against the torn fabric. For a moment, it bulged with the remaining air pressure from inside the suit. And then, to Cardass's horror, one edge began to come loose.
It won't bond to this material!
Maris bit out, glancing around her.
Help me find something to hold it!
Frantically, Cardass looked around, but there was nothing.
Never mind!
Maris gritted. She pushed down the edges of the patch again,
And then, with just a second of hesitation, she leaned over to lie chest to chest across his torso, pressing her stomach against the wound.
"Go get help!" she ordered. "Come on! This can't be doing his injuries any good!"
Breaking free of his paralysis, Cardass turned toward the door, and once again was nearly bowled over as two Chiss pushed past him, dropping to their knees on either side of their unconscious commander and the human lying across him.
"Prepare to move," one of them snapped, a large patch gripped between his hands.
"Move!"
Maris rolled away. Almost before she had cleared the wound area, the Chiss had his patch in place, completely covering the one Maris had tried to use. She pushed herself completely away, and Cardass saw thin tendrils of smoke drift up from the edges of the new patch.
"Seal good," the Chiss confirmed.
The second crewer was ready, jabbing the hose of a hand-sized air tank into a valve built into the helmet collar.
"Pressure stabilizing," he reported, peering at a row of indicator lights beside the valve.
"Can we help?"
Maris asked.
"You've already done so," the first Chiss said. "We'll handle it from here."
They had lifted Thrawn between them and were heading for the airtight door when the stars outside the canopy abruptly flashed into star lines.
For the first 2 hours, the medics worked behind sealed doors, with no news coming out, and only fresh supplies and more injured going in. Cardass hung around the medbay area, trying to stay out of the way, occasionally being pressed into service to run errands for the staff. He didn't know at first what had happened to Maris, but from bits of overheard conversation, he eventually learned she was helping clear debris from the bridge. They were still 4 hours from home when the two of them were finally summoned into medbay. They found Thrawn, half lying, half sitting, on a narrow bed inside a set of biosensor rings that wrapped around him from neck to knees like the ribs of a giant snake.
"Cardass, Ferassi," he greeted them. "I'm told I owe you my life. Thank you."
"It was mostly Maris, actually," Cardass said, not wanting to accept credit he didn't deserve. "She's faster in emergency situations than I am." "Comes of spending time with Rack on the Bargain Hunter," Maris said, trying a smile that didn't reach all the way to her eyes.
"How are you feeling?"
"Not well, but apparently out of danger," Thrawn said, studying her face.
"I'm also told you've been assisting with the task of clearing the bridge."
She shrugged self-consciously. "I wanted to help.
Even after I launched missiles against the Vagari's living shields."
She lowered her eyes.
"I'm sorry that I complained about that. I realize you didn't have any choice."
"Which doesn't necessarily make it easier to accept," Thrawn said. "It is, unfortunately, the sort of decision all warriors must make."
"Did we get the gravity projector, by the way?" Cardass asked. "I never heard one way or the other."
Thrawn nodded.
"It was collapsed and spark-welded to the outside of the hull just before we made our jump. All 6 of the fighters escaped as well."
Cardass shook his head.
"We were lucky."
"We had a good leader," Maris corrected.
"I'll kill her,"
Kento promised blackly as he glared at Maris and Cardass through the slotted plastic door of his cell.
"I ever get her alone, I swear I'll kill her."
"Just calm down," Maris soothed. "Tell us what happened."
"She tried to rob me, that's what happened," Kento bit out. "That stuff I picked out was ours. She had no business trying to take it away."
"And of course you told her so," Cardass murmured.
"I'd watch my mouth if I were you, kid,"
Kento warned, glaring at him.
"You may be teacher's pet here, but it's a long way back to civilization."
"So what happened to your collection?" Maris asked.
"She was going to take all of it with her," Kento said.
Luckily for me, that other Chiss, that Syndic myth-whatever...
Thrawn's brother? Maris interjected. Kanto's eyes widened.
No kidding. Anyway, he decided he needed to hear Thrawn's version first, so he made her leave it behind. But then she insisted it be put under prescribed seal, whatever the frizz that means.
So, bottom line is?
Cardass asked. Bottom line is that it's locked away somewhere,
Kanto growled.
And according to Syndic myth, whatever, even Thrawn can't get it out.
We'll check with him, Maris promised. Come on, George. Let's see if the commander's accepting company. At first, the guard outside Thrawn's quarters was reluctant to even inquire as to whether the commander would see them. But Maris eventually persuaded him to ask, and a minute later, they were standing at his bedside.
Yes, I saw Thras's report, he said when Maris had outlined the situation. Captain Kanto needs to learn how to control his temper.
Captain Kanto needs to learn how to control more than that, Maris said ruefully.
But being locked up has never done him any good before, and it's not likely to do anything now.
Can you get him released?
Yes. If you'll warn him about disrespecting Chiss command officers,
Thrawn said.
Perhaps we should simply lock him up whenever one is on the base.
Wouldn't be a bad idea, Maris agreed. Thank you.
What about the items your brother had sealed away?
Cardass asked.
Kanto will be impossible to live with until he gets them back.
Then it's time he began developing patience, Thrawn said. A syndic of the 8th ruling family has declared it sealed against a command officer's claim of possession. It cannot be unsealed until Admiral Ar-Alani returns to present her arguments.
When will that be?
Cardass asked.
Whenever she so chooses.
Behind Cardass, the door slid open. He turned, expecting to see one of the medics.
So, warrior's fortune has finally failed you,
Syndic Mithrasophis said as he strode into the room.
Welcome, Thrawn said, beckoning him in. Please, come in.
We need to speak, Thrawn,
Mithrasophis said, eyeing Cardass and Maris as he stepped to the other side of his brother's bed.
Alone.
You need not fear their presence,
Thrawn assured him. Nothing said will be repeated outside this room.
That's not the point, Mithrasophis said. We have Chiss business to discuss, which is none of their concern.
Perhaps not now, Thrawn said. But in the future, who knows?
Mithrasophis' eyes narrowed.
You think their thoughts will be of value? All thoughts are worth listening to, whether later judged to be of value or not,
Thrawn said.
But you came here with specific business to discuss. May my guests call you Thras, by the way?
Absolutely not, Mithrasophis said stiffly.
He looked at Maris, and his expression softened a little.
Though I understand you saved my brother's life, he added reluctantly.
I was glad I could help, Syndic Mithrasophis, Maris said in Chiyun.
Mithrasophis snorted and looked at Thrawn, and the hint of a wry smile finally touched his lips.
They really aren't very good at it, are they?
You could try Minisiat, Thrawn offered. Or you could use Sibisti, which I believe you also know.
Yes,
Mithrasophis said, switching to an oddly accented Sibisti.
If that would be easier.
Actually, we'd prefer you stick with Chiyun, if you don't mind,
Cardass said in that language.
We could use the practice.
That you could,
Mithrasophis said. He hesitated, then inclined his head.
And since you were both instrumental in saving my brother's life, I suppose it would be all right for you to call me Thras.
Maris bowed her head.
Thank you.
We're honored by your acceptance.
Thras turned back to Thrawn.
Now, he said, his tone hardening again, what exactly do you think you're doing?
The job for which I was commissioned.
Thrawn replied, I'm protecting the Ascendancy from its enemies.
It's enemies, Thras said, leaning on the word. Not potential enemies. Do you hear the difference?
Yes, Thrawn said. And no.
Thras lifted a hand, let it slap against his thigh. Let me be honest, Thrawn, he said. The Eighth ruling family is not happy with you.
They sent you all the way here to tell me that?
This isn't a joking matter, Thras spit out. That pirate treasure ship was bad enough, but this last escapade was far and away over all the lines, and right under an admiral's nose, too.
The Vagari aren't pirates, Thras,
Thrawn said, his voice low and earnest.
They're a completely nomadic species. Hundreds of thousands of them, perhaps millions. And sooner or later, they will reach the Ascendancy's borders.
Fine, Thras said. When they do, we'll destroy them.
But why wait until then? Thrawn pressed. Why leave our backs turned while millions of other beings are forced to suffer?
Thras sighed. Thrawn, you can't continue to push the lines this way, he said. Peaceful watchfulness is the Chiss way, and the 9 ruling families won't stand by forever while you ignore basic military doctrine. More to the point, the 8th family has made it clear that they'll release you before they permit your actions to damage their standing.
We were both born as commoners,
Thrawn reminded him.
I can live that way again if I have to.
For a long moment, the two brothers gazed at each other in silence. Then Thras sighed.
I don't understand you, Thrawn. I'm not sure I ever have.
Then just trust me, Thrawn suggested.
There, Sabaoth said, pointing through the viewport as their transport came around the curve of Yaga Minor. You see it?
Yes, Lorana said, as she gazed at the massive object hanging in low orbit over the planet. 6 of the brand new dreadnought warships, arranged in a hexagon pattern around a central storage core. The whole thing tied together by a series of massive turbolift pylons. It's quite impressive.
It's more than just impressive, Sabaoth said gravely. Therein lies the future of the galaxy.
Lorana stole a furtive glance at him. For the past 3 weeks, ever since her official elevation from Padawan to full Jedi Knight, Sabaoth had been showing a marked change in attitude. He spoke with her more often and at greater length, asking her opinion on politics and other matters, opening up to her as if to a full equal.
The crews and families are already aboard, stowing their gear and making final preparations, Sabaoth continued. So are most of the Jedi who'll be accompanying us, though 2 or 3 are still on their way. You'll want to meet them all before we leave, of course.
Of course, Lorana said automatically, feeling her muscles tense as a horrible thought suddenly occurred to her. When you say we, are you expecting me to come with you on outbound flight?
Of course, he said, frowning at her. Why else do you think I recommended your elevation to Jedi Knighthood so soon?
A familiar tightness wrapped itself around Lorana's chest. I thought it was because I was ready.
Obviously you were, Sabaoth said. But you still have much to learn.
Here, aboard outbound flight, I'll have the necessary time to teach you. But I can't go, Lorana protested. I haven't made any preparations. I haven't asked permission from the Jedi Council.
The Council has granted me whatever I need,
Sabaoth cut in tartly.
As for preparations, what sort of preparations does a Jedi need?
What about this one?
Tarkosa asked, tapping his fingers on a rack of negative couplings.
Jazz? Just a second.
Ulyar growled, scanning the racks already in place as he silently cursed the crowd of tech assistants the Supreme Chancellor's office had sent from Coruscant to help with the loading.
"It goes there," he told Tarkosa, pointing to a spot next to a rack of cooling pump parts.
"What in the worlds?"
a deep voice said from behind him. Ulyar turned to see a balding, middle-aged man in a plain tan robe standing in the doorway.
"Who are you?" he demanded.
"Jedi Master Justin Manin," the other said, his forehead creasing as he surveyed the chaos in the room. "This equipment should have been stowed 2 days ago."
"It was," Ulyar said. "Very badly. We're trying to fix it."
"Ah,"
Manin said, a wryly knowing look on his face.
"Better speed it up. Master Sebaeth is arriving today, and he won't be happy if he sees things this way."
With a nod, he turned and headed off down the corridor.
"Like Jedi happiness is our problem," Ulyar muttered under his breath at the empty doorway.
"The entire system can be run from here," Captain Pac-Milo said, waving a flippered hand around the vast combined operations center. "That means if there's an emergency or disaster on any of the ships, countermeasures can be instituted immediately without the need to physically send people to those sites."
"Impressive," Obi-Wan said, looking around. Situated just aft of the cross corridor behind the bridge monitor room complex, the comm op center stretched probably 30 meters aft and filled the entire space between the dreadnought's two main bow corridors. It was currently a hive of activity, with dozens of humans and aliens bustling around, and half the access panels and consoles open for last-minute checks or adjustment.
"What's that thing?"
Anakin asked, pointing to a low console two rows over from where they were standing.
"It looks like a pod racer control and monitor system."
"You have sharp eyes, young one,"
Pac-Milu said, his own large eyes rolling toward the boy.
"Yes, it is. We use it to control our fleet of speeders and swoops."
"You're joking," Obi-Wan said, frowning at the console. "You run swoops through these corridors."
"Outbound flight is a huge place, Master Kenobi,"
Pac-Milu reminded him.
"While each dreadnought is linked by the pylon turbolifts to its neighbors and the core, there's still a great deal of travel involved where the turbolifts do not go. Speeders are vital for moving crewers back and forth in both emergency and non-emergency situations."
"I understand you'll be making a short tour through Republic space before you enter the unknown regions,"
Obi-Wan said.
"A sort of shakedown cruise, yes,"
Pac-Milu said.
"We must confirm that our equipment is functioning properly before we go beyond reach of repair facilities."
He stepped to a nearby navigational console and touched a key, and a hollow of the galaxy appeared overhead.
"From here we go to Lonaw in Droma Sector," he said, pointing. "After that, we'll cut through the edge of Glythe Sector to Argai in Haldim Sector. Then we'll travel through Kokash and Mondress sectors, with a final stop possible in Albanan sector, if it seems necessary."
"That's a lot of stops," Obi-Wan said.
"Most will just be flybys,"
Pac-Milu assured him.
"We won't actually stop unless there are problems."
"What happens then?" Anakin asked.
"If all goes well, 3 weeks from now, we'll formally enter unknown space,"
Pac-Milu said.
"At a point approximately 230 light-years from the edge of wild space, we'll stop for a final navigational calibration."
His mouth tendrils wiggled as he shut down the hollow.
"And we'll then begin our journey in earnest, through the unknown regions and to the next galaxy."
Anakin whistled softly.
"How long before you'll get back?"
"Several years, at least," Pac-Milu told him.
"But the storage core has supplies enough for 10 years, and we expect to be able to supplement its stores of foodstuffs and water along the way."
In addition, our numbers may well diminish if we find hospitable worlds to colonize.
You're not just going to leave people behind in the unknown regions, are you? Anakin asked, frowning.
If we do, it will be with enough food and equipment to get settled,
Pakmilu assured him.
We would also leave one of the dreadnoughts behind for defense and transport. As you can see from outbound flight's design, it will be relatively easy to detach a single ship from the rest of the complex.
Anakin shook his head. Still sounds dangerous.
We are well prepared, Pakmilu reminded him. And of course we have 18 Jedi aboard. It will be safe.
Or at least as safe as one can be anywhere in these times, Obi-Wan murmured.
And it will be a glorious adventure as well,
Pakmilu continued, eyeing Anakin.
A pity you will not be joining us.
There are still a lot of things I want to do here, Anakin said, an unexpected flicker of emotion coloring his voice and sense. Besides, I can't leave my master until my training is complete.
With 6 Jedi Masters aboard, you would have several choices of a teacher,
Pakmilu pointed out. That's not really how it works, Obi-Wan told him. You said Master Sebaeth will be arriving soon.
He is in fact here.
Sebaeth's voice boomed from across the room. Obi-Wan turned. There, just entering the room, were Sebaeth and Lorana Jinsler.
This is a surprise, Master Kenobi,
Sebaeth continued as he strode casually through the bustle of activity.
I thought you'd be on your way back to Sularine by now.
I was relieved of that assignment, Obi-Wan said. There's something I need to discuss with you, Master Sebaeth.
Sebaeth nodded. Certainly. Go ahead.
Obi-Wan braced himself. Between Sebaeth and Anakin, this was likely to be unpleasant. Anakin and I would like to join the expedition. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Anakin turn to him in astonishment.
We would?
The boy asked. We would, Obi-Wan said firmly. At least to the edge of the galaxy.
And the final crew and passenger list, Captain Pakmilu said, handing over the last data card.
Thank you,
Doriana said, accepting the card and tucking the entire stack away inside his coat.
And there's nothing else you need?
Nothing that I or 50,000 other people have been able to think of,
Pakmilu said, with typically dry Mon Cal humor.
I believe outbound flight is ready to fly.
Excellent,
Doriana said. Supreme Chancellor Palpatine will be pleased to hear it.
We couldn't have done it without his help,
Pakmilu said gravely.
Please extend our gratitude one final time to him for all his efforts on our behalf.
I certainly will,
Doriana promised. Then that's that. Fly safely, and may the Force be with you.
With 19 Jedi aboard, I'm sure it will,
Pakmilu assured him.
Rather, 19 and a half.
Most definitely,
Doriana agreed, keeping his smile in place as he frowned behind it. 19 Jedi and a half.
Goodbye, Captain.
He waited until the pilot had maneuvered the transport out of Dreadnought 1's forward hangar bay and had them skimming smoothly across the outer fringes of Yaga Minor's atmosphere before he pulled out Pakmilu's passenger list and plugged it into his datapad. The last Jedi numbers he'd heard had put the total at 17, not 19. He pulled up the Jedi list and ran his eye down it. The names were very familiar. Most of them, potential troublemakers whom he himself had subtly nudged Sebaeth into inviting aboard his grand expedition. The first addition to the list, Lorana Jinsler, wasn't really a surprise. Doriana had always thought it likely that Sebaeth's former Padawan would decide to stay with him a while longer. The other two were Obi-Wan Kenobi and his Padawan, Anakin Skywalker. Doriana smiled to himself. So, Skywalker was Pakmilu's half-Jedi. Cute. And an unexpected bonus for all his hard work as well.
Their deaths aboard outbound flight would be nicely convenient. Outbound flight had disentangled itself from the last of its docking and support equipment now, and was making its ponderous way out of Yaga Miner's gravity well toward deep space. A minute later, as Doriana continued to watch through the transport's canopy, it flickered and vanished into hyperspace. He looked back down at his datapad. Still, bonus or not, he'd better check with Sidious and let him know that Kenobi and Skywalker were aboard, just to make sure that fit in with the Sith Lord's plans. And he'd better check before outbound flight meandered its way out of the Republic. Forever. The shuttle took him to the Yavidari spaceport, a few kilometers from the preparation center, where all the preliminary work on outbound flight had taken place. He'd left his own ship berthed on the far side of the spaceport, in the restricted zone reserved for diplomats and high governmental officials. Passing through security, he headed through the maze of corridors to his docking bay. He keyed open the hatch and went inside, locking it again behind him, then made his way to the cockpit. Seating himself in the pilot's seat, he punched for the tower. "This is Kinmon Doriana of Supreme Chancellor Palpatine's office," he identified himself when the controller answered. "Requesting a lift slot in 30 minutes."
"Acknowledged, Master Doriana," the other said. 30-minute lift slot confirmed." "Thank you." Shutting off the comm, Doriana keyed for full ship startup, watching the displays closely as the systems began coming online.
"You are late, Master Stratus."
Doriana gave the displays one more leisurely look. Then, just as leisurely, he turned around. The Nymoidian was wedged half-hidden in the hollow alcove off the cockpit's aft bulkhead, glowering at him from beneath his short, five-cornered hat.
"Vice Lord Sive Cav," Doriana greeted him. "May I say how very uncomfortable you look?"
"Very amusing," Cav growled. "You should have been here an hour ago."
"Why?" Doriana countered calmly. "Isn't your fleet ready?"
"Of course it is."
"An outbound flight only just now left," Doriana said. "Plenty of time to set up our ambush."
He cocked his head slightly. "Or are you simply annoyed that I made you hide there in your little hole longer than you expected?"
"I was not hiding," the Nymoidian insisted stiffly. "I simply did not wish to be seen if someone from the spaceport authority came in unexpectedly."
"Then if you'll return to your cabin, I have a ship to fly. You have the fleet's coordinates for me?"
"Yes."
Cav's long fingers dipped into a recess of his robe and emerged with a data card.
"It will take no more than 2 days to reach them."
"Good," Doriana said. "That should give us time to finalize our attack strategy."
"I am the one trained in battle tactics," the other said stiffly. "The attack strategy will be mine."
"Of course," Doriana said, suppressing a sigh. "I meant only that I'd be available to assist you. Now, if you'll return to your cabin, we'll be on our way."
The Nymoidian drew himself up, and with his pride at least momentarily appeased, strode from the room. Shaking his head, Doriana crossed to the hollow alcove. Positioning himself in the alcove, he keyed for a holonet relay. The lights winked on, and he signaled for his master.
"Report."
"Outbound flight is on its way, Lord Sidious," Doriana said. "I have Vice Lord Cav aboard, and we'll be heading for the rendezvous within the hour."
"Excellent. And you know precisely where in the unknown regions outbound flight will be stopping?"
"Yes, my lord. Captain Pakmilu has 2 separate navigational checks planned for the first 800 light years beyond Republic space. I have the coordinates of both."
"Be sure you take the first one. It may be that Sabaeth, in his impatience, will order the second to be cancelled."
"That is indeed my plan, my lord," Doriana confirmed. "One final matter. I have Pakmilu's final passenger listing, and 3 more Jedi have been added."
"One of them being Lorana Jinsla, no doubt."
"Yes, she's one of them,"
Doriana confirmed. The others are Obi-Wan Kenobi and his Padawan Anakin Skywalker. Sidious's smile vanished.
Skywalker? Who authorized this?
I don't know, my lord, Doriana said, feeling his heart starting to thud in his chest. The last time he'd seen Sidious like this, someone had died. Violently.
It must have been Sabaoth.
He cannot go on that ship. He must remain here. You will see to it.
Understood, my lord. Don't worry. I'll get him off. Doriana reached for the cutoff switch, his mind twirling as he tried to sort through the options.
Wait.
Doriana paused, his hand hovering over the control.
No, you continue with the plan. I will remove Skywalker from outbound flight.
Yes, my lord, Doriana said, wilting a little with relief. I'll contact you again when the mission has been accomplished.
Do that, Master Doriana.
Shutting down the holoprojector, Doriana went back to the pilot's chair and plugged Cab's data card into the reader slot. Time to find out exactly where they were going. The pylon turbo lift car door opened into yet another spacious lobby area. Okay, Anakin said, leaning out for a look. And this one is... He threw a not quite surreptitious look at the marking on the side. Dreadnought 4?
Correct,
Sabaoth said, putting a hand on the boy's shoulder and pressing him forward out of the car.
We're now at the farther side of outbound flight from the command ship, Dreadnought 1.
Rather like Tatooine in that respect, Obi-Wan added dryly. Right, Anakin said, only cooler and less sandy. Dreadnought 4's architecture and equipment, Obi-Wan noted, were identical to those of the other ships they'd visited on Sabaoth's tour. Not really surprising, considering how the expedition had been put together.
Jedi Master Justin Maning is in charge of this particular dreadnought, Sabaoth said as they headed aft. I believe you spoke with him at the first night dinner.
Yes, we chatted for a few minutes, Obi-Wan said. I thought Commander Omano was in charge of Dreadnought 4.
I meant that Master Maning oversees Jedi operations and activities,
Sabaoth said.
He should be back in Conference Room 5 with his two Jedi Knights and a select group of families. Let's go see how they're doing.
What were these families selected for? Obi-Wan asked.
The highest honor possible, Sabaoth said. Over the next few days, one of each family's children will be starting Jedi training.
Obi-Wan stared at him. Jedi training?
Indeed, Sabaoth confirmed. You see, along with their basic technical skills, prospective colonists were also screened for the presence of Force-sensitive children. Those families with the most promise were given preferential status, though, of course, we kept it a secret up until now. We have 11 candidates in all, including the three here in Dreadnought 4.
How old are these children? Obi-Wan asked.
They range in age from 4 to 10, Sabaoth said.
He cocked an eyebrow at Anakin.
Which is, I believe, the same age Master Skywalker was when you took him as your Padawan.
It is, Obi-Wan confirmed, feeling his lip twist. What about their parents?
What about them?
They've all given their permission for this training?
They will, Sabaoth assured him. As I said, giving a child to the Jedi is the highest honor possible.
So you haven't actually asked them yet?
Of course not, Sabaoth said, an edge of puzzlement creeping into his tone. What parent wouldn't be proud to have a Jedi son or daughter?
Obi-Wan braced himself. But if for some reason they don't see it that way...
Later, Sabaoth interrupted, gesturing to a door to their right. We're here.
The conference room was one of many mid-sized meeting areas scattered around a typical dreadnought. At the far end, standing beside a podium, was Jedi Master Maning, listening intently to a question from a woman in the front row. Flanking him, dressed in Jedi robes, were a pair of Duros. And seated in the rows of chairs in front of them,
nearly packing the available space, were perhaps 40 men, women, and children. Far more than the three families Sabaoth had implied would be here. Sabaoth was clearly surprised, too.
What in the...
He rumbled under his breath, his eyes flashing as he looked around. Maybe they brought their friends? Anakin suggested hesitantly.
Friends were not invited, Sabaoth growled.
He started to move forward, then seemed to think better of it. Instead, he gave an impatient gesture to his right. Turning that direction, Obi-Wan saw Lorana Jinsler detach herself from the back wall where she'd been standing and walk over to them. She nodded in greeting as she reached them.
Master Sabaoth, she said quietly. Master Meneng said you might drop in on us.
And it's fortunate that I did, Sabaoth said. What are all these people doing here?
Master Meneng invited all the secondaries and their families as well, Lorana told him. Secondaries? Obi-Wan asked.
Those with a small amount of latent force sensitivity. Too small for them to ever become Jedi,
Sabaoth said, glowering across the room at Meneng.
What about you, Jedi Jinsler? Why aren't you attending to your duties on Dreadnought 1?
Master Meneng asked me to come, she said, her voice a little strained.
Sabaoth rumbled deep in his throat.
I see.
Sabaoth strode down the aisle toward the front. Obi-Wan followed, Anakin and Lorana at his sides. As near as Obi-Wan could tell from the snatches of conversation he could hear, most of the people did indeed seem pleased or even excited by the fact that they had future Jedi in their families. Meneng nodded in greeting as the group approached.
Master Sabaoth, he said. Master Kenobi? Master Skye? What do you mean by bringing the secondaries to this meeting?
Sabaoth demanded.
I thought it would be useful to let everyone know at once why they'd been selected to fly an outbound flight, Meneng said. Since the secondaries are the ones most likely to produce Jedi offspring in the future, I thought they should know what to expect. That could have been dealt with if and when it happened, Sabaoth growled. This is not how it should have been. None of it is as it should be, Meneng countered. Children this age? And taking them from their families by force?
By force? Obi-Wan put in.
I don't expect force to be necessary,
Sabaoth insisted, glaring at Obi-Wan and Meneng in turn.
The few parents who have doubts will undoubtedly come around. Certainly the children themselves will be thrilled to begin their training. The question remains why we're even doing this, Meneng said. We're doing this because we're setting off on a long and dangerous trip, Sabaoth told him. We'll need all the Jedi we can get, far more than Master Yoda would permit me to invite. Very well. So we'll raise them up by ourselves. And please don't quote me that learned nonsense about how young a Jedi candidate has to be, because that's all it is, nonsense.
Master Yoda would disagree with you, Meneng said.
Then Master Yoda would be wrong, Sabaoth said flatly. We don't train children or adults because we choose not to. That's the only reason.
He gestured at Anakin.
Padawan Skywalker is proof that older children are trainable.
Meneng's lip twitched.
Perhaps, but there are other reasons for accepting only infants. What other reasons? Sabaoth asked. Tradition?
You do not approve of tradition, one of the Duros asked.
I don't approve of simply and blindly accepting it as truth, Sabaoth told him. Nor can we afford to do so. The lists of Jedi are shrinking, Master Kiga, all across the Republic. If we're to continue our role as the guardians of peace and justice, we must find ways to increase our numbers. By forcibly taking trainees from their parents? Meneng asked. Especially considering the fact that none of these parents had wanted their children to become Jedi in the first place.
But what about the child's wishes?
Sabaoth asked. Wouldn't it be more ethical to allow him or her to make that decision?
But there are good reasons for accepting only infants, Obi-Wan said.
most of which don't apply here, Sabaeth said firmly. There are no deep-rooted family hierarchies aboard outbound flight to deal with. Nor will the children be going hundreds or thousands of light years away to the temple on Coruscant, where their families will never see them again.
Beside Sabaeth, Lorana stirred but remained silent.
No, here there'll be merely a turbolift right away in the storage core, Sabaeth continued. After some initial training, we might even consider allowing them occasional evenings with their families. You're putting them in the storage core? Maning asked, frowning. I want the training center as far away from noise and mental confusion as possible, Sabaeth told him. There's plenty of room down there.
Maning shook his head.
I still don't like this, Master Sabaeth. New ideas are always discomforting, as are new ways of doing things, Sabaeth said, looking at each of the others in turn. In many ways, all of outbound flight is a grand experiment. And remember that if we're successful, we may return to the Republic with the key to a complete reinvigoration of the entire Jedi Order.
And if we don't succeed, Obi-Wan asked.
Then we fail, Sabaeth said stiffly. But we won't.
They were 6 standard days out of Yaga Minor and had stopped for a routine navigational check at Lonau System when the trouble started. A crowd had already gathered in the Dreadnought 2 aft passenger section when Obi-Wan arrived.
Let me through, please, he said, starting to ease his way through the mass of people.
Look, there's another one,
a Rodian muttered.
Another one what?
Obi-Wan asked, turning in that direction.
Another Jedi,
the Rodian said, looking him square in the face.
Easy, Feven,
a man nearby cautioned.
Don't start pointing blame.
Can you tell me what happened? Obi-Wan asked.
What happened is thieves in the night, the Rodian bit out. Thieves with robes and lightsabers.
Faveen, shut up, the man said.
He looked at Obi-Wan, lowered his eyes.
They came for someone's kid, that's all.
In the middle of the night,
Faveen insisted.
What night?
The man scoffed.
This is space. It's always night here. The family was sleeping, Faveen countered. That makes it night.
Thank you,
Obi-Wan said, easing away from them and continuing on through the crowd. Middle of ship's night or not, perhaps he ought to give Sabaeth a call. There was no need. He reached the open area in the center of the crowd to find that Sabaeth was already there.
Master Sabaeth, he said, taking in the rest of the scene with a glance.
Standing in the doorway to one of the rooms was a hulking figure of a man, his hands gripping the sides of the doorway as if daring anyone to pass. Behind him in the room was a frantic-eyed woman kneeling on the floor, clutching a young boy tightly to her. The child himself looked frightened, but also oddly intent.
Sabaeth half turned to frown at him.
What are you doing here?
He demanded.
I heard there was some commotion, Obi-Wan said, crossing to the doorway.
Hello? He said to the man.
You're not taking him,
the other said flatly.
I don't care how many of you there are. You're not taking him.
You have no choice, Sabaeth said flatly. As Jedi Master Evrios explained to you nearly a week ago, your son is a potential Jedi, and he's agreed to enter training. That means he comes with us.
Says who?
The man retorted.
Ship's law says decisions about children are made by their parents. I looked it up.
Ship's law wasn't written to cover this situation, Sabaeth said. It therefore doesn't apply.
So now you just throw out the law when it doesn't suit you?
Of course we don't throw it out, Sabaeth said. We merely rewrite it.
Who does? The man demanded. You Jedi?
Captain Pakmilu is the final legal authority aboard outbound flight, Obi-Wan put in. We'll call him and ask.
He may be the final legal authority, Sabaeth said, cutting him off with a warning glare. That remains to be seen.
Obi-Wan felt an uncomfortable tingling across his skin. What do you mean?
Outbound flight is first and foremost a Jedi project, Sabaeth reminded him. Jedi requirements therefore supersede all other authority.
Obi-Wan took a careful breath. May I see you for a moment, Master Sabaeth? In private?
Later, Sabaeth said, craning his neck over the crowd. Captain Pakmilu has arrived.
Obi-Wan turned to see the crowd opening up to let Pakmilu through.
Master Sabaeth, Master Kenobi, what is the problem?
They want to take my son away from me. The man in the door bit out.
The boy is to enter Jedi training,
Sabaeth said calmly.
His father seeks to deny him that right.
What right?
The man snapped.
His right? Our right? Your right?
The Jedi are the guardians of peace, Sabaeth reminded him.
As such, maybe in the Republic you are,
the man cut in.
But that's why we're leaving the Republic, isn't it? To get away from arbitrary rules and capricious justice and...
Perhaps we should wait until morning to discuss this, Obi-Wan interrupted. I think we'll all be calmer and clearer of mind then.
There's no need for that, Sabaeth insisted.
Master Kenobi speaks wisdom, Pakmilu said. We'll meet tomorrow after morning meal in Dreadnought 2's forward command conference room.
His eyes rolled to first the man, and then Sabaeth.
There you'll both have an opportunity to present your arguments, as well as relevant articles of Republic law.
Sabaeth exhaled loudly.
Very well, Captain, he said. Until tomorrow.
With a final look at the man and boy, he strode off, the crowd opening up even faster for him than it had for Pakmilu. Obi-Wan followed, making it through the gap before it closed again. For the first 100 meters, they walked in silence. Obi-Wan was starting to wonder if Sabaeth even knew he had tagged along when the other finally spoke.
You shouldn't have done that, Master Kenobi, Sabaeth rumbled. Jedi should never argue in public.
I was unaware that trying to clarify a situation qualified as arguing, Obi-Wan said, stretching to the Force for patience. Though if it comes to that, a Jedi should never deliberately antagonize the people he's supposed to be serving either.
Taking a child into Jedi training is not antagonism.
Doing so in the middle of the night is, Obi-Wan countered. There's no reason that couldn't have waited until morning. He paused.
Unless, of course, you were deliberately trying to force the issue of control. And why would I do that?
I don't know, Obi-Wan said. Particularly since the code specifically forbids Jedi to rule over others.
The Jedi Order has accumulated many rules over the centuries that are clearly erroneous. Why should this not be one of them?
Because Jedi aren't equipped to rule, Obi-Wan said. Because seeking power is the dark side.
And this is the engine compartment, Thrawn said, stepping aside to let Thrass look through the access hatchway into the Bargain Hunter's engine room. You'll notice it has a radically different layout from those of Chiss vessels this size.
Yes, Thrass said.
He peered inside a moment, then turned to Cardass.
What's the vessel's sublight range?
I'm not sure, Cardass said, looking over at Kento. The other was standing off to one side with Maris, who was whispering a running translation to him.
Rack?
He invited in Basic.
Why?
Kento growled.
Is he looking to take it for a test run or something?
Come on, Rack. Cardass cajoled, carefully avoiding Thrawn's eyes.
We can do 600 hours of sublight before refueling, Kento said grudgingly. 650, if we're careful with our acceleration.
Thank you. Switching back to Minisiat, Cardass translated for Thrass.
Impressive,
the Syndic said, taking another look at the engine compartment.
Their fuel efficiency must be slightly better than ours.
Yes, but their hyperdrives appear to be more fragile,
Thrawn said. Our shock net attacks disabled both theirs and their attackers without difficulty.
Weaponry?
Simple but adequate, Thrawn told him. The equipment is difficult to get to, but my experts have studied it at length. Their energy weapons and missiles are less sophisticated than ours, and they don't carry any shock nets or other disabling equipment. On the other hand, bear in mind that this is merely a small private freighter.
True.
Thrast looked at Cardass.
Your people do have war vessels, I presume.
The Republic has no army of its own, Cardass said, choosing his words carefully. Of course, most of our member systems have their own defense forces.
Which can also be used for attack?
That does happen sometimes, Cardass conceded. But the Supreme Chancellor can call on member systems to help stop an aggressor, and that usually ends things pretty quickly. Mediation by the Jedi can sometimes stop trouble before it gets that far.
Jedi?
A class of beings unknown to us, Thrawn told him. Ferassi has been trying to explain them to me. Cardass looked at Maris in surprise. He hadn't realized she'd been having private chats with the commander. They appear able to access some unknown energy field, Thrawn continued to his brother. It can be used for sensory enhancement, insight into others' motivations and thoughts, or as a direct weapon. But only for defense, Maris put in. Jedi never attack first.
You talking about Jedi?
Kento put in.
Cardass, did she say Jedi?
She's trying to describe the Jedi for him, Cardass said. The Chiss apparently don't have anything like them.
Good,
Kento grunted.
At least we topped them in something.
Through the row of viewports on the bridge of the Trade Federation battleship Dark Venge, the starlines faded once again into stars.
We have arrived,
Vice Lord Cav announced from his throne-like command chair. Doriana murmured noncommittally from a seat on the observer's couch, curving out beside the other. In general, the Nymoidians had excellent navigational systems, but systems were only as good as their operators. And in the Dark Venge's case, that was open to question. Sidious had insisted the crews of all the Task Force's ships be kept to a bare minimum, retaining only those who could be trusted to keep their mouths closed and bringing in droids to take up the slack.
Your concerns are needless,
Cav said haughtily, completely missing the direction Doriana's thoughts had taken.
We are double-checking the location now.
Thank you, Doriana said, inclining his head politely. The skeleton crew would not, of course, affect their attack capabilities to any great degree. That would be handled by droid starfighters, and that system was largely automated. He looked around the bridge at the Nymoidians and droids working busily in the various sunken control pits, then turned his attention to the tactical board. The task force was arranging itself into a typical Nymoidian defense structure. The two huge Trade Federation split-ring battleships in the center, where they would be best protected. The six armed Techno-Union hard-cell-class transports, forming a pyramid point defensive shell around them. And the seven Trade Federation escort cruisers, arrayed in a patrol cloud beyond that. It was an awesome collection of firepower, possibly the largest assembled in one place since the fiasco at Naboo. Against even the weaponry of six brand new dreadnoughts, they should have no trouble carrying the day. Assuming, of course, that Cav's navigators had indeed brought them to the right part of the right system. If they missed outbound flight here, they would have to hurry another 600 light-years ahead in order to catch it at its second navigational stop.
And this,
Sabaoth said, as he led the way into the unusually low-ceilinged room,
is the control room for weapons blister number one. You'll notice the ceiling is low, to make extra room for the turbo-laser charging equipment above us.
Luckily, we don't have any Gungans aboard, Obi-Wan commented, ducking his head a little as he stepped in.
Gungans wouldn't have been allowed anywhere near these stations, even if there were any aboard, Sabaeth said flatly. Weapons specialists need far more sophistication and intelligence than that.
In my experience, those two don't necessarily go together, Obi-Wan commented. And there are four of these blisters on each dreadnought?
Correct, Sabaeth said, crossing to the main firing console and resting his hand on the headrest of one of the chairs. Come and sit down, Master Skywalker.
Anakin glanced at Obi-Wan, then walked over and lowered himself gingerly into the seat.
Looks complicated, he commented.
Not really, Sabaeth said, pointing over his shoulder at the various sections of the board. Here are the actual firing controls. Note that you can aim and fire both the forward and aft turbo lasers from here, as well as your own starboard side weaponry. Over here is the sensor lock monitor. This is a secondary fire control. This is the weapon status board. This is the comm. This is the tactical display system. All quite straightforward.
Still pretty complicated, Anakin said. I'll bet I can design a better layout.
I'm sure you could, Sabaeth said, throwing Obi-Wan an amused smile. Unfortunately, Rendili's star drive didn't think to consult any Jedi during production. Still, you'll learn it quickly enough. We'll start with an overall tutorial and then a simple simulation. You access both over here.
Wait a minute, Obi-Wan said, frowning as he stepped to Anakin's other side. What are you doing?
I'm teaching Master Skywalker how to handle Dreadnought 1's weaponry, of course, Sabaeth said.
Doesn't Captain Pakmilu already have experienced crewers for that job?
Experience is not always the most important aspect of combat, Sabaeth pointed out. Timing and coordination are also key, and no amount of experience can give ordinary gunners the edge that we already possess. Tell me, Master Skywalker, has Master Kenobi ever spoken to you of the Jedi Meld?
I don't think so, Anakin said. What does it do?
It permits a group of Jedi to connect their minds so closely as to act as a single person, Sabaeth told him.
It can also be very dangerous, Obi-Wan warned. It takes a Jedi Master of great power and depth in the Force to create such a state without killing or destroying the minds of everyone involved.
A Jedi Master such as myself, Sabaeth said calmly. I've successfully performed such a meld on four separate occasions.
Obi-Wan stared at him.
Four?
Three were training exercises, of course, Sabaeth conceded. But the fourth was under serious field conditions, with five other Jedi in the meld. As you can see, we came through it successfully.
That was with six of you, Obi-Wan pointed out. There are 19 of us aboard outbound flight.
20, including Master Skywalker. Sabaeth corrected, laying a hand on Anakin's shoulder. Certainly we'll need to proceed with caution. I'll be discussing the procedure with each of my Jedi, and we'll be carrying out a number of practice sessions before we leave Republic space. Still, once we're all comfortable with the technique, we'll become an awesome fighting force indeed. With Jedi working as one at the weapon systems of all six dreadnoughts, outbound flight will be virtually unbeatable.
Kardas started awake to find a pair of glowing red eyes hovering above him in the darkness.
Who is it?
He asked anxiously.
Thrawn. The commander's voice came back.
Get dressed. What's happened?
Kardas asked as he pushed off the blanket and swung his legs over the edge of the bed.
One of my scouts has reported a group of unidentified vessels in the area, Thrawn said. Quickly now! We leave in 30 minutes.
45 minutes later, the Springhawk cleared the asteroid tunnel and made the jump to light speed. And not just the Springhawk. Before they made the jump, Kardas counted no fewer than 11 other ships forming up around and behind them, including two more Springhawk-sized cruisers.
Is this more Vagari?
He asked as the star lines melted into the hyperspace sky.
It doesn't appear to be, Thrawn said. The ship designs are entirely different. I wanted you aboard to see if you can identify them.
So where exactly are these invaders? Cardass asked.
Why do you call them invaders?
Well, I... Cardass floundered. I just assumed they were in Chiss space after that talk you had with your brother. He frowned.
They are in Chiss space, aren't they?
The charter of the Expansionary Defense Fleet is to observe and explore the region around the Chiss Ascendancy, Thrawn said.